Welcome to Stories of Stories. I'm your host, Mike Chin. In each edition of this podcast, I explore the stories behind a specific creative project, process, or experience. I'll be talking about projects on this show with the expectation that either you're already familiar with the project I'm talking about, so for example, if it's a story, you've already read it, or you don't plan to read it. Regardless, what I'm trying to get at is this podcast will include spoilers, so please listen no further if you don't want anything spoiled. In this episode, I'll be discussing the MFA in Creative Writing. For the uninitiated, that's the Master of Fine Arts. And so this is a slightly different topic for a podcast than what I ordinarily do. For regular listeners, you might have generally heard me speaking about specific short stories or poems or essays or even websites that I've worked with. In this particular case, I'm talking about an experience. A while back, I did an episode in which I talked about the MFA application process. It was one of the most listened to episodes, so I got the impression that people were interested in hearing about that. And this time, I'm taking a step back to talk about the MFA in general. This podcast, you can listen to it from a variety of different lenses. I think people who've been through the MFA, for some of you, maybe this will bring up some nostalgia, or maybe they'll bring up some points of kind of controversy of things you may, disagree with or might, agree with but not have thought of in that way before. I would say, in many ways, my primary audience for this podcast is more people who have not had the MFA experience, though. People who might be considering applying, or maybe they've even been accepted to MFA programs, and are trying to decide whether or not they'll actually go. If this podcast drops around the time that I'm expecting it will, then it'll be in a time when I expect people are probably actively applying for this process. Though I know one part of the nature of podcasts is that people will listen to it when they listen to it. It's audio on demand, and so while I expect this will drop during a window of time when people might be applying, it might be that people won't actually come across this until months, if not years later. So take it for what you will. But I think besides talking about the MFA application process, it's worthwhile to actually consider why people would consider pursuing an MFA in the first place, and if it's worth it. I think there are a lot of questions out there about what an MFA actually does and the culture around it. And so that's sort of what I'm tackling in this podcast. And obviously, I only have my own experience to call on. And that's a caveat I'll put on this whole show. And I'm sure I'll probably say it a number of times as I'm recording here. So I apologize for the redundancy. But I'm sure I'll also forget to say it after I've made some grand proclamation. And then people might, think that I'm kind of, trying to speak, universally where that doesn't embody their own experience. So I will say, very blatantly, very openly, that I think everyone does have a different experience, and whether or not the MFA is the right track and where to pursue that MFA and at what point in life to pursue that MFA really does vary from person to person. And having attended an MFA program, I've only attended the one. I took a class in another program, and I did do another graduate degree that I'll speak about, but I only went to the one MFA program as a matriculated student. My view on the matter is limited to that. But even in that experience, I met my whole cohort of folks, fiction writers like myself, as well as poets and essay writers. And, through that experience, I think, some people, I think overarching, I think in general, everyone who I went to grad school with, I think enjoyed the experience. Though I think there would be varying degrees of, how people would follow up on that in terms of saying, for sure, this was worthwhile, this was life-changing, this was great, versus those who might say, it was good, but, in retrospect, maybe I shouldn't have gone, maybe I would have done something differently. And then there are those who I'm sure fall anywhere on that spectrum, or maybe even had a negative experience that I'm a little bit less aware of as I'm recording this, but I can't claim to know the internal thoughts of everyone. So, again, we go back to kind of that core question, though, of if the MFA is the right choice. I think the answer really is different for everyone. I think a big piece of it is what your ambitions are as you're considering going into a program of this nature. I think in its purest form, people go to an MFA program to have time to really hone and improve and just actually write. And that's kind of the bottom line there. If you come in with expectations of, you know, getting a book deal out of it or making those kinds of connections that will lead to one, you know, that's a little bit less certain road. And I'll talk more about that over the course of the podcast. I think certain programs emphasize that more. Certain programs, you know, are more successful in leading students in that route. But whether that's the right thing in general, that, again, I think is in and of itself subject to different experiences and you know, what people want. But so there's a big question in terms of what you want out of your MFA experience. Like, that's worth really considering before anyone, you know, does go into a program like that. I think your current place in life matters a lot, too, in that question. That's something, again, I'll get into more as we go along. But when I went to the program, I went at a point where I felt really sure that I wanted to go, and I'll discuss more about how I knew that. But also it's a matter of finances. I come from a place of relative privilege where, you know, coming out of college, I was, you know, consistently employed. Prior to going to my MFA program, I had never been unemployed for longer than a month, and I'd worked just about that whole time pretty consistently with two specific jobs that were both very good to me and both gave me opportunity to save some money. And so I know that's not the reality for everyone. And I'll talk more about this, but the fact that I applied to, you know, 34 MFA programs, that's no small amount of money to have paid between application fees and, taking the GRE and even having GRE scores and transcripts sent to all these different, schools. That's one piece that I know I didn't calculate for when I initially applied for MFA programs, and was, ultimately just given the number of programs I applied to, that was several hundreds of dollars that we're talking about there. So I was in a position to be able to, you know, save and plan for that application process and for going into a period when I wasn't going to be making very much money being a full-time student again. And I know that's not, you know, realistic for everyone. And there are, you know, low residency MFA programs that make that, I think, more realistic for a lot of people, especially those with, you know, family obligations or who work more on a regular calendar where they're able to get some time away to attend a program in person for shorter periods of time. But in any event, I say all of this by way of getting at, again, it's really, you know, kind of an individual choice whether the MFA is the right choice and how to pursue it and what kind of geographic bounds to put on that and what kind of programs to prioritize. So I'm discussing here my experience, and that's only my experience, but hopefully there are pieces of it that will allow you to kind of extrapolate from it and pick up on your own sense of, you know, what you would want out of that experience, or again, for those listeners who have been through it, the MFA experience, how that kind of stacks up with yours. I'm sure there are some similarities. I'm also sure that there are some differences. So when I actually started my program, I drove cross country from Maryland to Oregon to start the program at Oregon State. Along that drive, I turned 31. So I wasn't the eldest member of my cohort, but I was up there. There were only a small handful of people who I was working with that time who were older. Not the age even matters that much, but I think it's something that a lot of people think about is, you know, when the right time to do this is in their life. And I think especially when you're fresh out of college, I think that there's that impulse to do this soon. But before you're too old for it. That might be the right choice for some people. I question that as a legitimate choice. I'm glad I waited until I did to do it. So I guess to use kind of a clumsy metaphor for this, part of what I thought about was, recreationally, I do some weight training. You may or may not know it by looking at me. But my best friend kind of got me into it. My best friend from childhood, he's more serious about it. He got started sooner. I would argue he's a little bit more genetically predisposed to it. But you would more know it by looking at him, that he's a weightlifter. Like most people I shouldn't even say most, but like, I think a lot of people who, at some point or another get into weight training, you start looking at all these supplements and whatnot, and I won't deny that I had a period where I was, taking weight gain shakes, to try to bulk up a little bit, and where, I took creatine pills for a short period of time. you know, and it's different for everyone, but there's this idea that you know, that you need these things to get ahead or to, you know, maximize your gains or whatnot. And in retrospect, if I could go back and talk to myself, you know, one of the things I advise myself in weight training is just not to do any of that stuff. You know, if I got stuff for free that seemed reputable and safe, that happened a couple times, you know, sure, why not take something like that? But in general, you know, something I came to as a decision after, you know, a few years of doing it and in conversation with my friend there was this idea of getting as far as I possibly could, and then if I really wanted to use some substances, using some substances. I'm not talking about steroids or anything that serious. You know, I never got even close to that. But this idea that, you know, really to get the most out of those experiences, to justify using those things, get as far as you possibly can completely naturally, and then start tinkering with the other pieces, like specialized nutrition and like supplements. Because at that point, then you're really pushing the boundaries of what your body is capable and what's worthwhile. So I promise this isn't going to turn into you know, a bodybuilding podcast by any sense. But I think, you know, relating that to my writing, I think one thing that I feel fortunate to have done was I feel to have taken my writing as far as I was going to on my own. So, you know, and I think for some people, you know, if you are 100% sure that, you know, writing is your path, and if you, you know, really make some serious progress during your undergrad and are starting to publish in nationally recognized journals and whatnot, you know, maybe you're there. Maybe it does make sense for you to strike while the iron's hot, you know, and capitalize on kind of the momentum you've accumulated over the course of your undergrad experience. And this is something that, in retrospect, I mentioned earlier, I did apply to MFA programs once before I applied straight out of undergrad. And, you know, I think that there's a good guiding principle of if you have a faculty member, a creative writing instructor who you really trust, who you've gotten along with, and you have reason to believe is credible, you know, if they advise you to wait, that's a really good sign to wait. If they're pushing you, you know, go for it now, you're ready, that's a different story. And again, this is not universal advice, but if it's someone who, you know, is pushing you to continue on, that's a good sign. Maybe you are ready. I know I got the advice to wait, when I was, kind of my undergrad. And in retrospect, you know, I really respect, the professor who gave me that advice. And I think I probably came across as, you know, kind of disrespectful and kind of an arrogant young man when I, you know, didn't take it as seriously, at the moment when I was 21 years old. But, looking back on it, I really do think that she was right. And I was better off having had more life experience before I started the program. But again, you know, that's not the case for everyone. And I think there is some merit to getting that jump on your professional career. You know, I was, you know, by the time I came out of my MFA program and was seriously starting to apply for faculty jobs and whatnot, you know, I was in my early to mid 30s. Whereas, you know, I have people, you know, from my cohort who are, you know, still in their mid-20s, and so they're obviously just at an earlier point in life to be able to pursue all of the professional things that come after an MFA. So there are those merits there. But I do feel, you know, fortunate in retrospect that when I first applied for MFA programs straight out of undergrad, I only applied for, you know, two MFA programs and one MA program. The MA program is the only one that admitted me and, you know, not with full funding. And so in retrospect, I'm glad that happened, because it's one of those things where, you know, maybe I lost a little momentum for a short period of time on my writing, but in the long term, I had 8 years of writing time. I did an MA program as well that, through my employer, I was able to get tuition remission on and just do night school. And, you know, it took 5 years to finish it, but I was able to get a free master's degree out of that, and grew immensely as a writer through that experience as well. And I think probably the most important piece of all, I had time to learn to fit reading and writing into my schedule as a working professional. I think that's one of the potential perils of going directly from undergrad into an MFA program is you never have that time in between to adjust and figure out what your writing life would actually look like kind of out in the wild. And so to have had that time, you know, when I had to learn to, you know, balance the professional schedule and find time for writing and where I could squeeze it in between the cracks, and where I could, you know, kind of keep it as a central piece of my life, even when most of the people around me, that wasn't a central piece of their lives. All of that was an invaluable experience. That allowed me when I actually did start an MFA program that it felt like this huge wealth of time, to be able able to write, and it also, I think, set me up for a better transition coming out of the MFA program to keep up that momentum on my own, because I had plenty of experience with it at that point. But okay, so in terms of, you know, what an MFA experience does offer, I think to me, probably the most valuable piece of it overall was just this immersion factor. Just being immersed in this world where people care about literature and they care about writing and they're trying to write themselves. You know, it's this crazy thing where I would go weeks where almost every single day I'd be writing down a new recommendation of a book or a story or entire author that I should be checking out. That's something that just rarely happens outside of this kind of environment, unless you're, you know, very fortunate just to have kind of this life centered on literature. But I know I'd never really just had that kind of experience before. And I was also exposed to other literary forms. So, you know, I considered myself a fiction writer. I had certainly dabbled with poetry in the past, and I've done a lot of blogging, but I considered really kind of my literary efforts to be centered on fiction. You know, I just hung out a lot with people who were writing poetry, who were working on essays. And I took this one, you know, incredibly influential class on my work about hybrid forms with Jennifer Richter that really kind of re-illuminated kind of this idea that I could write poetry. And particularly this idea of writing prose poetry, it removed a lot of my personal kind of discomfort and, you know, lack of confidence about how to kind of operate the proper mechanics of poetry, and really, you know, gave me an opportunity to kind of reaccess that world, think about that as a way of writing and kind of crystallizing a particular moment, as opposed to, you know, always focusing on character development and telling a story. So, you know, with that, it's a place where all these things matter, you know, and I think about, you know, my friends who are, you know, kind of into nerd culture and go to Comic-Con events, and, you know, that's not necessarily my world. I've, you know, gone to, you know, days of a few of those events, and I think they're fun, but, you know, I'm not really in that world the same way that some of my friends are. But, you know, it's that immersion experience where for that period of days, you're among your people. You're among these people who care about the same things that you do, who can insightfully debate about these topics that are completely esoteric and don't really come up in day-to-day life so much. I think that it's that kind of immersion to have had that for 2 years in my MFA program, and you know, increasingly there's a lot of programs that are 3 years and some even four. But I think that was kind of what the main thing that I took was 2 years to kind of be completely in that world, and that to be the most important thing going on in my intellectual life, and not have a job that I had to focus on, you know, 7 or 8 hours out of a day, and then squeeze in the writing with the rest of that time. I know this was the thing. So I think it's worth touching upon funding when it comes to MFA programs. I talked about this in the application episode as well. But, you know, I think it is worth noting, and I like to think most people are well aware of this, but I remember myself kind of bright-eyed and bushy-tailed when I was, you know, kind of coming, you know, when I was in college and when I was immediately out of that experience, and how these visions of being this super wealthy, successful author, and that does happen for people. I mean, it's not impossible, but I remember once hearing a visiting author, you know, talk about this, and I don't remember the precise statistic that this person cited, but I remember them saying something to the effect of that it's percentage-wise easier to be an NBA basketball player than it is to be a writer who supports themselves purely on their literary written work. There are those people, but when you talk about kind of the level of, you know, both the elite talent, but then also just kind of, you know, good fortune, connecting with an audience and having the marketing savvy and all of these pieces, to not have another job that they're doing or not have a partner who's supporting them, but to have that be their primary or only source of income, it's that difficult for it to happen. And so it's not really realistic to go into an MFA program assuming that's going to be the outcome. So I say all that to get at this idea that, you know, a lot of MFA programs offer full funding, if not to everyone, then at least to a substantial number of people in their program. And so, yeah, you know, I my personal advice in general is not to pursue a program unless you have that full funding. Obviously, you know, I come from a place of relative privilege. There are people who are a lot more privileged than I am as well. If you're independently wealthy and have millions of dollars to blow, you know, maybe that's not a concern. Maybe spending, you know, $100,000 over a few year period with no real income and just purely focusing on writing, is something that you can justify doing. And if so, that's awesome. You know, more power to you. I recommend you make some charitable donations with your wealth as well. But, if you want to pursue that life's passion, you know, be my guest. That's great. But with programs that offer full funding, that's where I think most of us fall if we're going to be practical at all about it. I don't think it makes sense to go in debt over an MFA. I think if you, you know, go through an application cycle and you don't have funding offers on the table, I think it does make sense to wait another year or two and refine, you know, what you're working on and try again. But with funding, it's important to note that, that funding doesn't come free. It's not like you're just given that funding for being talented. I know some programs do offer fellowships and whatnot. And so there are people who do get, you know, one or more year of funding, just for being really good. But for most of us, that funding, comes with, the caveat that you're working for the money. And that's often in teaching. In some cases, that's in tutoring, or in, you know, various other work, for the college or university you're affiliated with. I think the most common setup for that is that you're either teaching or TAing. And so, that is a significant time commitment, especially the very first semester or quarter, that you're teaching, or if you're tasked with teaching more than one section. It's something that does take a lot of time for lesson planning, especially if you haven't taught before, to develop kind of your confidence and your game plan and how you're going to tackle class, let alone those periods of grading. You know, because if students get stressed out about a deadline and having a big paper due, you'd better believe that exists on the other side for the teacher as well, having to grade that many big papers in a relatively finite period of time. So recognizing that as much as, you know, it is going to be an immersive experience, as much as, an MFA program, in my opinion, is going to offer you more time, commitment to writing than you will in just about any other point in life. By the same token, that's not to say it's going to be the only priority. There are going to be these other pieces, and teaching can be a big part of it, for a lot of people. And again, this is where, I think, you know, coming from an experience of working a pretty busy office job, that was a lot less rough, kind of adjustment for me, is a lot smoother adjustment, to go into that. I think from people who had, you know, not had that kind of experience before, that was all the more challenging to figure out how am I going to find time to write, amongst, you know, trying to teach, in addition to having any semblance of a social life and, you know, maintaining kind of fitness regimen and any of these pieces, it all does become pretty full. So the next thing I wanted to touch on here was just this element of selectivity in MFA programs. So it's one of those things where, you know, I was fortunate to, you know, be accepted to a number of programs and to kind of get my pick of them and to go to, a program that seemed like just a really good fit for me on a number of levels, you know, that was extremely selective, that admitted about 2% of applicants. And that's not that outlandish. I remember the first time I applied for MFA programs, when I saw that the ones I was applying to typically only let in like 6 people a year, you know, that was pretty daunting. So it's like, wow, that's, you know, like, I don't know how many hundred people are applying, but to only have 6, those odds are not good. And that's, in looking at it, you know, more objectively, that's actually a pretty important thing, I think. So if you're going to a program that does accept, you know, more than 10% of its applicants, you know, more than 20%, there does come a point where you start questioning of kind of, you know, where are the gatekeepers on this? You know, what's the quality control in terms of, the people coming into this program? And that can come across as elitist or snobbish. I know that's one of the main criticisms of MFA programs, is this idea that you have to have an MFA to, you know, write seriously, because there are plenty of great writers in the world who do not have that pedigree. But at the same time, it's not meaningless, right? So people are applying to MFA programs or people being admitted to MFA programs. It does establish some sort of baseline for quality of work this person has previously been capable of, usually as demonstrated through, the writing sample, pretty universally. That's what I've heard is the primary consideration in admissions offers. So obviously, personal statements and recommendations and things like that matter a lot too, and to a lesser extent, things like previous academic record and publications and resume and all of that. I think it's one of those things that, when I took classes in my undergraduate, when I participated in various conferences and workshops, even when I did, my MA program, I was working with kind of self-identified writers. Whereas, at the MFA program, these were self-identified writers, but they were also writers who'd been vetted, by faculty at the program who'd really narrowed down that pool. And only invited people who, they felt would be a good fit. And there are levels to all of this. Obviously there are programs like Iowa and Michigan are kind of the most famous, creative writing programs. And they get the most applicants, they have their pick of the litter. I think it can be that much more difficult to get in. And if you look at places, like there's that MFA draft page on Facebook, and there's certainly value there. There's certainly very smart people there. Personally, my opinion is that page is really toxic, just because I think while there are some really well-meaning and really well-informed people, there are also people who are not as well-informed. And I think there are also just people who have a lot of really, strong experience and knowledge behind them, but who nonetheless kind of impose their view of the world. And I think it can turn into a pretty mean-spirited place at times. And so, for those people, they might say, if someone doesn't get into Iowa or Michigan, then what business do they have giving advice? There is a certain level of, really just logical, you can kind of deduce that, because if those are the most selective programs, if someone didn't, get admitted to those programs, then who are they to give advice about getting into the best programs? And that's, to a degree, that's fair. But I think to me, there's those different levels. Not everyone's going to get to go to Iowa, and everyone's going to get to go to Michigan. I'll be transparent. I applied to both. I did not get offered admission to either. I applied to 34 programs, though, most of which were fully funded. And ultimately, when I did have my choice of them, I felt comfortable that if I did, go to any of these given programs, that kind of narrowed down to my final few, that I was going to a place where the bar would be appropriately high, where, it was a selective program, where people had earned their spots through their accumulation of experiences and through their writing. And so that's where I think that selectivity is important. And so, if you apply to a lot of programs, you don't get offered admission anywhere. I think that is a sign of, taking some time to, rework things. And if you are, going into a program, I think it's also important to kind of cut yourself some slack in noting that you've already cleared a pretty massive hurdle. And that's not to say that you can rest on your laurels at that point, but it is to say that you're among kind of your appropriate cohort of people who have also decided to apply in that cycle, who have also been offered admission, and that there are going to be people that you learn from. In my experience with the MFA, I felt really fortunate with my cohort, some really smart people, some really sharp writers, and we had a lot of differences. One of the writers I respect most in that group, we had some really clear kind of aesthetic differences that showed up pretty early in workshop. I think it's one of those things where by the end of the program, and early on even, I just really respected her, and I think that there's real value in that. I think we were coming from, I would suggest objectively, a fairly similar skill level, and so I think in those differences of opinion, we actually had some good things to learn from each other over the course of time we spent in that program. So in talking about kind of the components of an MFA program, obviously I've alluded to workshop, and I would hope anyone who's listening is probably familiar with creative writing workshops, although that's not necessarily a given. I know that some people may be interested in pursuing this who didn't, study creative writing in college, in which case there's a very real possibility you haven't encountered a writing workshop. the basic idea of it is just kind of, you know, writing something on a schedule and then submitting it to the rest of the class. And so, you know, with my program, it was a 2-year program. There were 6 fiction writers in each cohort. So do the math. Each quarter, there were 12 people in that workshop. And so, you know, twice during each quarter, I would submit a story or a collection of flash pieces, as would everyone else. And we'd read each other's work. We'd provide written comments, and we'd discuss it for close to an hour in class each week. To me, there are very few substitutes for the workshop. I think, you know, obviously there are certain voices that you privilege over others, either because you just respect them more, or they kind of speak to your aesthetic more. But I think there's just really just no substitute for hearing kind of a mass of voices around, especially well-read voices. And so, you know, I'm not going to claim that every workshop is created equally or that everyone, you know, has been a great experience for me even, but I think that it's definitely something where that's the core, at least in my understanding, of the MFA process. And this is, again, something where it can vary from program to program. At Oregon State, at least, there were also craft classes. That's where I talk about taking that class in, you know, hybrid forms that I alluded to. You took a great seminar that introduced, you know, literary magazines and kind of how they operate. Took another one on first-person narrators in fiction. You know, had one on the uncanny novella, incorporating uncanny elements in writing. I got to experiment with nonfiction and looking at you know, recent nonfiction books, and a class on magazine writing. And all of these pieces, to me, that was so valuable as well, and kind of the perfect complement to the workshop experience. Because while the workshop, I think that's where I really refined you know, my writing. And kind of developed, you know, in the form that I'd come to write in fiction. But I think it's these craft classes that really kind of opened my eyes to other kinds of writing that I could do. And so, you know, beyond that, there are these, you know, a literature and or a pedagogy component at a lot of graduate programs. I know at Oregon State, it was basically you had to take one graduate level literature course. I think it was pre-1800s was the bar that they set. And one class in pedagogy, because you were all on teaching assistantships. And so the idea that we would, you know, learn that kind of pedagogical theory to go with it. To me, those were probably my least favorite parts of the MFA experience. It's one of those things where, you know, I think you can make a real argument that it's important to have kind of that foundation in you know, more traditional literature and in teaching. But to me, those were the parts that kind of slowed the momentum of the program a little bit. I think that there are some that, you know, benefit some people more based on your style of writing that might have benefited some people more. For me, I kind of feel like I'd had that experience already, you know, through my undergraduate and through my own reading. And, you know, I was fortunate to work with great teachers. I mean, it wasn't their fault. It was just kind of the setup of the program. And I know that's an experience that, from what I can gather, is pretty common at different graduate writing programs. There's also the thesis component, and that's fairly universal from what I can gather, but the idea that you're writing a more substantial body of work that you've kind of revised you know, a number of times, working closely with an advisor over the course of your program. I think with some graduate programs, there's more the clear-cut intention of emerging with that thesis more or less being a book that's, you know, essentially ready to go and be sent out. I know that was a little bit less of an emphasis at Oregon State. It was more kind of just, you know, you have these, I want to say it was like 60 to 80 pages or somewhere in that ballpark, where, you know, these are the ones where you're going to have some special intensive attention working directly with your advisor, who's going to read through draft after draft. You know, and I went through a solid, you know, at least four or five, and I think in some cases more drafts of each of the stories that I used for my thesis in that process. And I think got a lot out of it. And then, you know, a little bit less formally, but I think, you know, most MFAs also have this part of the program that involves, you know, visiting writers coming in and doing readings. And a lot of times they're there for either the general public or at least the whole college community. But sometimes people in the graduate writing program might get kind of special access and might have, you know, additional reading that just they're able to attend, or a seminar led by them, or a question and answer session. And that's something else I feel like I got a ton out of in this program. You know, it's this is my inexact math coming out, but I always suggest that I feel like going into my MFA program, I knew, you know, maybe 2% of what there is to know about the publishing industry and about literary magazines. And coming out of the program, I feel like maybe I knew like 30% of what there is to know. That still means that there's so much out there that I don't know, and I wouldn't claim to be an expert on. But it also does mean that I know a heck of a lot more than I did going in. And I think that's from a business perspective. I know some programs are more oriented towards the business of writing and emphasize publishing more. That's not the kind of program that I attended at my time at Oregon State. But I think even in a program that had less emphasis on it, that still was something that really shone through as just kind of an inevitable part of being around people who are invested in this world. And I think that especially came out, again, with those visitors to campus. So in terms of what you're not going to get out of an MFA program, I think, again, there's a lot of cynicism around the whole MFA model. And to be real about it, so I know this was my experience. I didn't get an agent out of it. I didn't get a publishing deal out of it. And I think that's true for most people who go to MFA programs. I think that there are exceptions with some of those, really big name programs, or with, some of the ones that are based in New York and have, more direct affiliations with publishers. But, in general, it's something where I think you can learn a lot about these worlds, but you can't expect it just to kind of be given to you. It's not like you got admitted to an MFA program, therefore with that you're going to get a book contract. It doesn't work that way, at least in my experience. That's generally not what happens. I think there's this question of, whether someone would do it again, whether, it was a worthwhile experience. And I can say unequivocally, yes. I think it's one of the best things that I did in my adult life. I think some of the more cynicism or some of the more jaded opinions come from people who, struggle to write after they come out of the program, or who had a bad experience in workshop, or who, struggle to find jobs afterwards. And I will be real about this. Coming out of my MFA program, that's the longest period of unemployment I've had in my adult life. I had a summer gig teaching and then doing some administrative work. And then I went through the fall essentially unemployed. I picked up some, odd jobs here and there, but it wasn't until going into the new year, even, so a good, whatever that was, about, 4 month period or so, that I was able to, find more sustainable work. And then it was, another few months after that before I really landed a position that directly followed from my MFA experience. And, I'm recording this a while before the episode's going to drop, and I can't say for sure where I'm going to be at that point professionally. But I can say that, this isn't necessarily an endeavor to do purely for, economical reasons or job reasons. I do know one writer who was fairly successful and, had books published and won awards, who went back to get an MFA just because she needed to have, a graduate degree to add on to her CV at that point in order to be taken seriously for teaching jobs. I think for most of us, that's kind of the reverse direction it works. And we get the graduate degree, then we get the books done. It's one of those things that, financially, economically, I probably would have been better off sticking in my office job straight through. But in terms of having, time to write, having that immersion, and meeting the people I met there, it's just one of those invaluable experiences that, I wouldn't trade for much anything in my life. And I think it is up to the individual person coming out of an MFA program to keep up on the writing. And I think that there's a lot of that, paralysis that can follow from no longer having a workshop group and no longer having an advisor and all the accountability and all the feedback that comes with that. I think that's another reason for the argument of kind of waiting before going to an MFA program, to have more confidence in yourself, to kind of build yourself up to a point where you feel, like you can do this on your own before you start, get as far as you possibly can, and then start it and see how far that can take you, as I was talking about earlier in the episode. But also there's just this piece of, just not letting all those pieces of the MFA program go afterwards. Everyone's going to have their own, work obligations and family obligations and all of those things. And, at least in my experience, I doubt I'll ever have another experience as immersive as I did during my MFA. We have kept up an online workshop where, my cohort and I and a couple other folks will meet up generally once a month to go to over someone's story. So the pace is a lot slower. And everyone's got competing obligations, but there still is that outlet to get feedback. And there's also just this piece, I think, that people tend to underutilize of just reaching out to someone individually, a friend. And I think no one wants to impose or whatnot, but just reaching out to someone saying, hey, I wrote this story. I'd really love, your feedback on it. I remember you were a really good reader for me, during our time in the program, or this seems to kind of fit your aesthetic. If it's not too much of an imposition, I'd love it if you could read it and give me a few notes. And the worst that happens is someone says no. Maybe they're really busy at that time, they can't commit to it, but I think that's something that I think can get lost outside the context of a program. So that's my two cents on the MFA in creative writing. I know a lot of people have a lot of different experiences, and I by no means claim this is definitive or the be-all, end-all, but just some food for thought, and hopefully this has conjured up some more ideas and maybe some questions you want to ask either yourself or some other people. For anyone listening to this podcast who'd like to reach out to me, again, someone who's on the front end of this experience or applying for programs or considering whether to apply to programs, feel free to reach out to me. I think if you've stumbled upon this podcast, you probably have some form of contact information for me. If all else fails, try to reach out to me on Twitter. It's Mike T. Chin, T as in Tom, and I'd be happy to start a conversation with you there as time permits. So we'll move ahead now to Mike's monthly endorsement. So as an artist, I think it's important to be consuming other things to see what interests and inspires you and to see what's already out there and what may have come before you. So at the end of these episodes, I'm recommending a book, a story, a movie, a TV show, a band, a wrestling match, anything along these lines that may have escaped a huge mainstream audience or that might be a little bit dated now and at the cusp of being forgotten, but that I recommend to you. So this was a little bit of an offbeat episode in terms of the subject matter I was focusing on for the episode itself. And so I thought it would kind of be fitting to also do kind of an offbeat pick for my monthly endorsement. So I'm going to suggest actually a Twitter account in this case. And the Twitter account is Guy in Your MFA Program. And I know that this is actually, it's a pretty popular Twitter account, but again, this is popular, within the context of the literary circles that I've been in, and, that's not really a universal audience by any stretch of the imagination. So the way this account works is kind of the most kind of, stereotypical, pretentious, cliche, white guy in a graduate writing program. And I think it's really funny. It kind of captures some of our frustrations around kind of that culture, kind of the stereotypes of, what might be wrong with an MFA program or its culture. And I think it's just kind of interesting to follow and good for a laugh, as you kind of, need it. I think anyone invested in the literary community, I think anyone who's ever taken any creative writing classes or interacted with that kind of community can probably relate to this on some level of someone you know like this, or maybe you caught yourself being like this at some point. I think it's a worthwhile look. So again, that's a Guy in Your MFA Program. That's a Twitter account. All right. Well, I want to thank you all for listening. And as always, I want to thank Mike Peek for providing the theme music for this show. I'm wishing you all good health, happiness, and creativity. And I'll catch you next time.